All right, cool. Well, thanks everyone for coming to the breakout. Yeah.
Awesome.
My name's Ted Harrington. This is my business partner, Eli Meze. And we're here to do a continuation of the session from earlier this morning. I'll show hands who here was at the main stage presentation that I gave. Does anybody nod at that? Okay, so a few of you. So you should probably leave now. We'll recover the high points. But basically, to recap, this morning we talked about sort of the high-level discussion of what are the areas that we need to cover in order to arrive at a system that would satisfy studios in terms of acceptance from a security perspective, at least based on our experience of helping organizations pursue this. Again, we should reiterate that we are not the content owners. We do not make the final decision, but we'd certainly help content owners make the decision by providing insight and data points. So what we're going to do now in this session is drill a little bit deeper into applying some of the security principles and concepts that I alluded to earlier today. And Eli will certainly take us deeper into some of those. He lives and breathes in some of these cloud workflows. And he's embedded with one of the content owners. And so he definitely knows a thing or two about a thing or two. That's right. All right, so just to recap, to refresh a couple things, we perform security assessments. Most of you saw me talk about why I think we're great already, so I won't need to do that again. But the reason that this is up here is to remind you of what's woven through everything that we'll talk about today is this adversarial perspective. You know, we should always be thinking about how the attacker thinks because that should help us inform our defense paradigm. So what will we talk about in this breakout session? Three things. We are going to provide some context around the topic area. We're going to briefly reintroduce the security models, which I talked about at a surface level earlier. And then most of the time we're going to spend on is applying principles. So let's get right into that. And as we go through this, by the way, smaller room, obviously, a little more intimate. We have prepared content that can take us through the whole 30 minutes, but if you guys want to interrupt, ask questions, and go down a different path, we'd be happy to do that too. So feel free to. Okay, so let's provide some context. First and foremost, workflows drive security, and certainly not the other way around. In a high-paced environment that is the production of content, you see a wide range of different parties all collaborating under intense timeline pressures, and the last thing that any of them ever want to hear is, hold on, we got to slow this down for security. So that's the reality we have to live in, and that's okay, that's actually a good thing. And so security really needs to tie into that and support that. And security should not be a something that does not enable the production process. This should be straightforward, but in a lot of times, a lot of cases we see in the real world setting is actually not applied very well, is the idea that the workflow really must be understood in depth before considering security. We talked earlier this morning about this idea of being careful about avoiding checkbox security, and the idea of saying, just give me the best practices, or give me the list, I'll do the list, whatever's on that, I'll do that, and I'm not going to do anything else. That is in a vacuum, and doesn't necessarily take into context what the workflow is. And then finally, simplicity is your friend. The simplest solution is going to be the most secure type of workflows. So Eli, maybe you want to talk to us about burst rendering a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ted mentioned there's been a huge move in media and entertainment specifically towards the cloud, because as we move into the future and as we scale for the future, the needs for computing, for storage, and for other core services that have historically been handled on-premise or through physical workstations just cannot be met going forward. So in this case, we have something unique where we have a well-established security model that's existed for quite some time. VFX rendering is something that has existed since, I think Jurassic Park was the first major to have large-scale VFX rendering on it. And from there, that is the workflow model that has been propagated through the industry. And there are some very specific controls that have been in place as a result of that, having to do with custody of keys, key rotation, asset storage, access to content, and transfer of content in and out of your workstation. One of the requirements for rendering in the past was that everything happened on an air-gapped network where you don't have access to the internet. And when you think about cloud workflows and you think about moving to the cloud, it seems almost antithetical to take something that's air-gapped and move it from a process done on-premise in a secure VLAN in a facility that you know and trust and open it up to the cloud. However, if you look at some of the core services that exist with really any provider, whether we're talking about Amazon, Microsoft, or Google, the tools exist to allow you to recreate that security model, and it's understanding what those models are. So in the case of burst rendering, you have your artist zone, you have those nodes that are offline, and now in order to burst out to the cloud, for those instances where you're not able to scale on-premise, you're able to put in line, to put in place dedicated connections out to cloud provider of your choosing, or a secure connection through a VPN or VPC of a cloud provider of your choosing, set some pretty specific policies having to do with how machines or services are configured, what the policies are that govern them, and all the other core services that go into allowing you to run this load in an area that acts more as an extension of your trusted physical infrastructure and not so much as a shared cloud service. So we're going to get into some concepts talking about these core services, how they're used, how to leverage them, and how to really replicate the security model that we've come to know and understand in media entertainment and grow on it. This example over here is a rudimentary way of recreating that security model using things like Direct Connect, VPC, KMS, and other services that I'll get into a little bit later. There's actually a nice guide that we published with Amazon and one for Microsoft and one for Google services that kind of walk you through how to configure these services and how to faithfully recreate that security model. But this, in a nutshell, is how you would do it at a high level.
Any questions before we move on? Okay. All right, so to refresh some of these security models that we talked about earlier today, you might remember we talked about the idea of building out threat models and trust models, and how a threat model is a exercise through which you identify assets, adversaries, and attack surfaces, and trust model is where you identify who you trust, why you trust them, and how you validate that trust. So as we get into all of these, we want to, of course, keep in mind that those are going to be front and center of thinking about how you apply security to the workflow. Just another visual representation of the combination here of assets, adversaries, and architecture that is part of threat modeling. So earlier today, you might recall, I introduced this concept of secure design principles. So what a principle is a principle is, of course, a universally understood truth, and a secure design principle is one upon which systems resilient against attack are built. I mentioned earlier, as you might recall, that these aren't necessarily my opinion, although we certainly believe in them. These are really the research and academic communities coming together and agreeing that this is how you build these systems. So I put up on the screen earlier today, and I'll show it again in a moment, but there are about 12 of them, depending who you ask. There might be a few, a small number fewer or a small number more. We're going to cover, depending on time, at least two, maybe four of them, and talk about them in this workflow context. So let's get into the meat of that. So first we want to talk about are some principles surrounding privilege. On one hand, we have the idea of the principle of least privilege. So the principle of least privilege essentially says that you want to provide the minimum amount of power to any given user that enables them to perform their function and nothing more. Now, in a, shall we say, ego-driven industry that is media and entertainment, you're going to have a lot of executives who say they should have access to everything. They want everything to be easy because I'm the boss. That's actually consistent across a lot of industries. they shouldn't have access to everything. They should have access just to the things that they need, because the more access they have, the more likely they are to be the point of compromise. The way that we always like to think about least privilege is like a chessboard. You want your opponent to have a large number of low-skilled adversaries, so like pawns, and a very small number of high-skilled adversaries, which would be like your queens. Where organizations fail is when they set up their opponent's board like it's all queens, which is what really overly permissive privilege would be like. And then there is privilege separation, and that's the idea where you want to try to separate privileges so that, again, what you're doing with all of these types of principles is it's mitigating, first, the likelihood of compromise, and B, minimizing the amount of damage that happens in the event of a compromise. So Eli, with that, maybe you want to talk about some of these in the context of cloud providers.
Sure, absolutely. So when we talk about cloud services and how best to configure them, when we talk about something like privilege control, the tools that we need are there to allow us to map to any workflow. The way it generally works is you have an idea of who the users are, and you use a tool for identity management. In the case of Azure, AWS, and Google, they all offer full suite identity services. From there, you can determine who your administrators are, or queens on the board, your pawns, who would be your workers and services who are doing repetitive tasks, compute nodes, things of the like. Beyond that, you're able to send policies as to how and when they're able to access content. You can do that by tying the IAM role and the policy that you created to some sort of encryption process using a key management system. With AWS and Azure and GCP, they all offer multiple different ways to do this. And as I mentioned earlier, we're talking about well-established workflows that have been in place for decades at this point, with very specific requirements as to who has custody of those keys. In many cases, the operation that's handling the service should not be custodian of the key. Each of these solutions allow you to allow for key management, where the content owner could either be the key the owner of the key and then propagate permissions down to any of the content users through those IAM roles and policies, or the custodian of the content in the form of your VFX house or in the form of your colorists are able to do that as well. And then you're able to do go a step further and actually use network segmentation and segregation around other services like storage to ensure that your productions, whether you're talking about something that's coming from Paramount, Sony, Disney, that all of them are segregated, that you understand who the players are who are going to be accessing content there, that you're ensuring that there's no cross-pollination of content through that workflow, and that you're faithfully recreating that model that's existed for decades at this point. With these, we're kind of glossing over these services, but there are many, many more, and each one of these are incredibly powerful. If there is a well-established workflow that you understand, you can create that workflow. You can recreate that workflow in the cloud. If you want to do something completely new and move from on-premise to cloud-native, you could do that as well. But as Ted mentioned earlier, understanding how you're going to get there, understanding who the stakeholders are who are going to need a certain level of access, and having safeguards in place around that level of access, critically important. These are three services or three service categories that you can use for privilege control. And within each of these, there are multiple different trees that you can go down in order to get as germane as you need on the privilege control principle. So we put together an example implementation over here. And with this, you're able to see that there are different buckets that are set up using S3 privileges with KMS sitting on top of it with these nice little icons, where you're segregating high-value assets from other lower-value assets, and you actually have logical controls using services like using VPC services to segment out each of those items as if they're their own individual organizations within this cloud environment that you're creating. So in this case, we're talking about apps and value-add services, but it could very easily be three separate productions from three separate production companies where jobs are being farmed out and you have an idea of exactly what operations are occurring on content in this environment. The point here is you can create as sophisticated as a security model as you need with these network services. So if you're able to do it on-premise, you could probably do it in the cloud, and you could probably do it better with better insight into the workflow and more intelligence into the operations leveraging some of these core services.
Cool. Defense in depth. So the next principle is, of course, to talk about defense in depth. So this is the idea of building layers of defense to both try to prevent incidents and to mitigate the impact in the event of an incident. I think the way to conceptually think about it is sort of what this diagram shows, but the idea of thinking about what are the assets that you care most about and build layers of defense emanating outwards from there. So this readily applies, of course, in a cloud context. And again, we have a similar matrix, obviously, with different categories. So,
Yeah. So with this, defense in depth, if we think about defense in depth and how we build extra layers of control, one of the core concerns that we hear from content owners over and over and over again is we do not want our content accessed over the public internet. We need to find a way to not allow public internet access to a given piece of content. Well, every cloud provider that you work with, or any of the major cloud providers that you work with, offer the ability to direct connect to your data center, where you're able to have a dedicated line from your center out to their data center that no one else is able to traverse. So think of it as a means of circumventing the public internet to share this content, and a fast lane out into your environment for those compute or storage intensive loads that are going to require an insane amount of bandwidth. Beyond that, as I mentioned earlier, you have the ability to segregate accounts and delineate between clients once the content actually makes its way there. So understanding the difference between your Transformers movie and your Assassin's Creed movie or your Star Wars movie is going to be incredibly important in terms of who is able to access what, which models are then propagated and moved out to a given workstation or service in order to create the image. And just enforce what is expected in terms of segregating access to given pieces of assets. And then on top of that, if you want to get extra paranoid and you want to make sure that your artists are going to only be accessing workstations that you trust and that there are multiple layers of authentication that exist there, either on the VDI approach, which is virtual desktop, or on your access to cloud console, you're able to throw in other defense in depth measures like multi-factor authentication, where username and password aren't going to be enough. And if you want to get more in the weeds, you're able to do things like IP whitelisting and other controls that just allow you to have a very robust model when it comes to security, where the things that you've been doing on-premise and the things that you've been accustomed to doing over the past several years you're now able to do in a manner that scales using services that are battle-tested over time. Yeah. So in this case, as I mentioned, Direct Connect is huge. When we start talking about things like rendering of frames, and we start talking about rendering in 4K and UHD and 8K, and the storage and compute resources that come into it, I don't think that there's a data center that exists that a client controls that'll be able to run those loads for multiple tentpoles at a given time. So you need to have the ability to scale out, and you need to have the ability to get your content from point A to point B quickly and securely. And in the case over here, we've expanded on the burst render scenario that we've discussed by throwing in in this case, it would be ExpressRoute through Azure, and having MFA, multi-factor authentication, on access to your console to set up permissions governing your roles, your policies, and your key management. It's one of these things where it makes sense. It's incredibly easy to do, and there's a wonderful audit trail that exists beyond this as you move through that solution.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So next principle we'll talk about is trust reluctance. Some people also refer to this as assume hostility. Basically, the premise of the principle here is we should all look like this guy. We should all have a skeptical side eye at everything and not necessarily trust immediately. Now, this one is hard psychologically, I think, as human beings. We default to trust. If we shake someone's hand or we look them in the eye, we hire that person, we immediately trust that person. Inherently, until that person erodes that trust. It should actually be the other way around. And that's what trust reluctance is all about, is determining who you should trust and why you should trust them, and then allocating and provisioning that trust. And so in a cloud context, there are many ways that you can control that and be reluctant to trust. And here are some of them.
Yeah. And what's great about the cloud is every action that exists, every action that is conducted within your environment is actually going to be shipped off, and there will be a record of it. And you, as paying customer, is able to set a policy as to how long you have those records for, what actions you take on those records, and additional business intelligence. So one of the principles that Ted talked about earlier had to do with privilege separation. And in the case of your administrator, it's very hard to separate permissions from administrator being able to conduct system events in terms of requisitioning new users, transferring assets that he or she may not, should not be transferring, and then having access to system logs because they own the machines that actions are occurring on. In the case of the cloud, using AWS, Azure, or GCP, there are actually services that exist that allow you to separate those two. So any action that occurs can be shipped off and audited and monitored and controlled by a group or a different organization within your business, which now means that if you have a rogue actor internally at your company who is doing something that he or she should not be doing, they can't go and cover their tracks by deleting logs or updating system information where that nefarious activity occurred. In the case of all of these services exist, and then there are policy centers around there that allow you to do things like aggregate the logs, set policies for how long you want to keep them, and then based on certain actions, create alerts or actually create system intelligence. So if you see an administrator account is being created, you can alert the world that this is happening, and if it's legitimate, the folks who should be in the know can disregard it and say not a big deal. But if it's not legitimate, well, now all relevant stakeholders who are tied to a given piece of media or to a given campaign are able to say, oh, this happened, we should probably do something. And if you want to take it a step further, you can go through approval processes where, as that occurs, other folks have to come in and approve it. Or you can say, well, we see suspicious system activity. We see someone is passing raw code in through an input box. This doesn't seem right. No one should be doing this. We're going to revoke this account, and we're going to do it immediately. You can build in this type of intelligence into your system using these core services. But again, it comes back to understanding what your workflow is, what individuals should be doing within the confines of that workflow, and designing something that's going to be resilient against the most skilled of adversaries, including an administrator who's gone rogue or an administrator's account who has been compromised. And yeah, if we want to go to the next slide.
Yeah, well, actually, we have about 5 minutes left.
Yeah, we do. And I have another talk that I have to get to. So rather than walking you through an example, let's open it up to questions and see if you guys have any questions or if there are items that we want to discuss.
What sort of bandwidth is required? Like, I know like you can get a direct connection to the cloud, but minimal bandwidth requirement that you can get things done.
Well, when you say things done, are we talking about compute intensive?
Yeah.
You're probably going to need it.
10 gig.
Yeah, it's tough to say, but I would say at least a gig, like at a bare minimum, and that may not be enough depending on how much you're actually sending through the pipe. But you are going to need some dedicated bandwidth, and you are going to need the means to have an SLA in place where in peak hours you're still getting that level of service. So I've seen minimum about a gig. You can go as high as 10 gig. You can go even higher than that with some of these providers. Yes?
Do you see situations where this is reversed so that like the pipe would actually not need to be so large because, in fact, the media is in the cloud and only the small amount that needs to be worked on specifically is brought down?
Yes. Eventually we will get there, but that's going to require buy-in on the part of the content owner where the process needs to be cloud native. And the great thing about a situation like that is when you go full cloud native, your content owner is able to define the policies having to do with access and having to do with workflows that are able to then tie into that storage or tie into the resources that are required in order to complete an operation. But until that happens, there is going to have to be this ingress-egress model where you get your content from probably a non-cloud provider up into the cloud, and it is going to require bandwidth, and it is going to require a custom workflow in order to do.
But so if you're starting from zero, which obviously Visual Effects House is not, but every production is, so when they start, they have zero data anywhere.
Correct.
is there an argument for them to make home the cloud and only bring locally what they're working with?
Price is a big, the storage, cloud storage is real expensive. That's
It all depends, but there is a case eventually. Because now you don't have to worry about ingress and egress, and you have a greater level of control when you do that. The thing is, it requires buy-in on the part of content owner, and it requires a quantum shift in thinking. It's not the way things are done now, which means that getting there is going to take time, and there is going to be user acceptance, and there are going to be politics around the process. And I have no doubt that at some point in the future, industry will be there, but it's not ready yet. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Are there any cross-compatibility between those three platforms?
There can be, using third parties and services that have custom connectors written for each one of them. But if you're using core services from one for, say, storage, and you have other native workflows built into it, it probably makes sense to pick your preferred provider. It's tough to be cloud agnostic. It isn't impossible, but it's tough to be cloud agnostic.
So the rendering could happen in one location, but you have to transfer the data.
Correct, and then you have to get into ingress and egress costs and workflows. You have to deal with potential caching appliances in order to make sure that there isn't a hit in terms of latency and bandwidth, and it requires additional engineering. I do think that some of the large players in the industry are going to find a way to get there, where if you do have storage or you have these services that exist with a provider, they're able to plug in nicely to it, but it is one of those things that requires a fair amount of engineering and is not trivially simple.
Parties that are like, you like this third party's process that they can do, and you like that third party's process that they can do, but they're on AWS and they're on GCP and you're on Azure, and should that be part of your selection process in finding providers?
It should be. It absolutely should be built into it, because it is going to add additional costs and complexity. And if it's one of those things where you're dealing with a shop that is able to do a specific job better than others, and they are 100% Google or they're 100% Amazon and you're not, that creates a discussion and that creates issues. And if you'll excuse me, I actually have to get to the next talk that's starting in a minute, so I'm going to kick it over to Ted. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll wrap up now, guys.